A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about survival training, the kind special forces units get, and he's got a book on his shelf by a former operator that covers practical skills. But the real question is, what does advanced survival training actually contain when you strip away the Hollywood gloss? What foundational skills should a preparedness-minded civilian actually learn? And with in-person survival courses popping up everywhere now, what do those typically cover? There's a lot to unpack here, and I suspect most people's mental model of this is about 60% Bear Grylls and 40% things that would get you killed.
The drinking your own urine school of wilderness preparedness.
Which, to be fair, is a real technique that exists in the literature. It's just not the first thing you reach for.
It's absolutely not. And that's actually a perfect entry point, because the gap between what survival training actually is and what popular culture depicts is enormous. I went down a rabbit hole on this. The formal framework that most Western Special Operations units build from is called ASEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. It originated with the U Air Force after the Korean War, when they realized pilots shot down behind enemy lines had zero training for what came next. The program was formally established in the late 1950s, and it's since become the gold standard across NATO and Allied forces.
Four letters, and each one is a completely different discipline. Survival is keeping yourself alive in the wilderness. Evasion is not getting caught. Resistance is what happens when you do get caught. And escape is getting out.
And most civilian survival courses only touch the first S. Maybe a little bit of the E for evasion if you're doing one of those tactical cosplay weekends. But the full Suri pipeline is designed for people who might genuinely be hunted. It's psychological as much as physical. The resistance phase, in particular, is infamous. It's designed to simulate captivity and interrogation, and it's so intense that there's a whole body of literature on the psychological after-effects for trainees.
I've read some of that. The term resistance training sounds noble until you realize it involves stress positions, sensory deprivation, and simulated executions. And the instructors aren't role-playing. They're trained to break you.
And the logic is straightforward. Better to experience a controlled version of that breakdown in training than to discover your limits for the first time in a real cell. But let's pull back to the survival piece, because that's where the practical, transferable skills live. The core of survival training, the part that applies whether you're a Green Beret or a hiker who took a wrong turn, is built around what instructors call the rule of threes. You can survive 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without shelter in extreme conditions, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food.
Which immediately tells you the priority order. Most people fixate on food. They picture themselves fashioning a fishing spear or setting snares. But food is last on the list. Shelter and water are what kill you.
Shelter is first, which surprises people. But hypothermia doesn't care about your protein intake. In most wilderness environments, exposure is the number one killer. Military Survival Manual, the multi-service FM-2176, devotes more pages to shelter construction than to any other topic, and the shelters they teach are not the elaborate log cabins people imagine. They're debris huts, lean-tos, snow caves, things you can build in under an hour with no tools.
The debris hut is the one that looks like a pile of leaves with a person inside.
That's exactly what it is. And it works because dead dry leaves and pine needles create dead air space. They trap your body heat. A properly built debris hut can keep you alive in temperatures well below freezing with no fire. The technique is to pile up about 3 feet of compressed debris on all sides, leaving just enough room for your body, and then plug the entrance behind you. It's miserable and claustrophobic, but it works.
Miserable and claustrophobic, but it works, is basically the subtitle of the survival training manual.
It really is. And that's a theme I want to keep returning to. Survival skills are not about comfort, they're about not dying. The gap between what looks good on YouTube and what actually keeps you alive is vast. Everyone wants to learn bow drills and hand drills and flint and steel, and those are valid skills. But the foundational firecraft that survival instructors actually emphasize is site preparation, tinder selection, and understanding how to build a fire that will catch in wet conditions. The ignition method is almost secondary.
Because if you can't prepare a fire properly, even a Bic lighter won't save you.
And speaking of Bic lighters, every serious survival instructor I've read carries at least two. The romance of primitive fire making is real, and it's a valuable backup skill. But in a genuine survival situation, you use the most reliable ignition source available. The Special Forces guys aren't out there rubbing sticks together for the aesthetic. They're carrying multiple redundant fire sources. Lighters, ferro rods, waterproof matches.
Let's walk through the actual curriculum. If I sign up for a civilian survival course, what am I going to spend my weekend learning?
Most introductory courses follow a similar structure. Day one is usually the survival mindset and priorities of work. The priorities of work is a military concept. It's an ordered checklist of what you do in the first minutes and hours of a survival situation. Step one is always security. Treat any injuries, get out of immediate danger. Step two is signaling and communication. Step three is shelter. Step four is water. Step five is fire. And step six, way down the list, is food.
Signaling before shelter is interesting. Most people would think the other way around.
It depends on the scenario. If you're a downed pilot with a radio and a rescue beacon, absolutely. Your best chance of survival is getting picked up quickly. For a civilian hiker who's lost, the same logic applies. The sooner you signal, the sooner search and rescue can find you. Most people who die in the wilderness are found within a few miles of a trail or road. They just weren't visible.
Which gets into the psychology piece. One of the things I've read is that survival training spends a surprising amount of time on what they call survival stress management. It's not a skills gap that kills people. It's panic.
That's well documented. There was a fascinating study done by the U-Coast Guard on survival rates in maritime emergencies. They found that a huge predictor of survival wasn't physical fitness or technical knowledge. It was whether the person had mentally rehearsed the possibility of the emergency before it happened. People who had thought about what they would do, even casually, were dramatically more likely to take effective action. People who hadn't tended to freeze or make catastrophic decisions.
The mental rehearsal piece is something civilians can do for free. You don't need a course for that. Just sit down and think through what you'd do if your car broke down in a remote area, or if you got separated from your group on a hike.
And that dovetails with another core concept in advanced survival training called stay or go decision making. When you realize you're lost or in trouble, the single most consequential decision you'll make is whether to stay put and wait for rescue or try to self-extract. The data overwhelmingly favors staying put. Search and rescue teams find stationary targets much faster than moving ones. But people have a powerful psychological drive to do something, to walk toward what they think is safety. And that's how a lost hiker becomes a body at the bottom of a ravine.
Stay or go is one of those phrases that sounds simple until you're cold, scared, and your brain is screaming at you to move.
The military teaches specific protocols for this. The acronym STOP is common. Stop, think, observe, plan. Just forcing yourself to sit down for 5 minutes before taking any action. It sounds trivial. It's not. Under acute stress, your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that does rational planning, is partially inhibited. Your amygdala is running the show. The act of deliberately sitting down and taking stock is a way of re-engaging higher cognitive function.
Far we've covered shelter, fire, signaling, and the mental game. What about water? That's the 3-day problem.
Water is where things get technically interesting. Finding water is one thing. Most survival manuals cover the basics of following animal trails downhill, looking for green vegetation in dry areas, collecting dew, that sort of thing. But the real skill is water purification, because drinking untreated water in a survival situation can kill you faster than dehydration. Giardia, Cryptosporidium, all kinds of bacterial contaminants. The standard military method is a combination of filtration and chemical treatment. A portable filter plus iodine tablets or chlorine dioxide.
Boiling is the universal backup.
Boiling is the gold standard. 1 minute of a rolling boil at sea level, 3 minutes at altitude. But it requires fire in a container, which you may not have. So the layered approach is, filter if you can, chemically treat as a backup, boil as the failsafe. And there's an emerging technology piece here too. Ultraviolet purification devices like the SteriPen have gotten small and reliable enough that some units are carrying them, but they're battery dependent, which creates its own failure mode.
The civilian takeaway is, carry a filter, carry purification tablets, and know how to boil water with what you have.
Know how to improvise a container. That's one of those skills that sounds trivial but can be a showstopper. If you lose your water bottle, can you make something that holds water? Burning out a wooden bowl, using a plastic bag, fashioning a container from birch bark. These are skills that take practice.
Let's talk about the knife situation. There's a whole subculture around survival knives, and I suspect most of it is marketing.
The knife discourse is endless and mostly ridiculous. Here's what actual survival instructors say. The best survival knife is a fixed blade knife with a blade between 4 and 6 inches, full tang, meaning the metal extends through the handle, with a comfortable grip and a blade that's not too thick to do fine work. That's it. You don't need a hollow handle filled with matches. You don't need a sawback spine. You don't need a blade that can baton through a cinder block. You need something that can carve, cut cordage, prepare food, and make feather sticks for fire starting. A feather stick is a stick you've carved with thin curls of wood still attached, like a feather duster made of kindling. It's one of the most reliable ways to get a fire going in wet conditions, because the thin curls catch easily. It's also a skill that takes practice. You're cutting with the grain at a shallow angle, creating curls, but not cutting them off. It's one of those things that looks easy when an instructor does it and is infuriatingly difficult the first 20 times you try.
Infuriatingly difficult the first 20 times describes most survival skills, I'd imagine.
It does, and that's actually an important point about the in-person courses. The value of a course isn't that someone tells you things you could read in a book, it's that you get hands-on practice with immediate feedback. You find out that your debris hut has gaps you didn't notice. You discover that your feather sticks are garbage and your bow drill technique is wrong and you've been holding the knife in a way that will give you blisters in an hour. The feedback loop is what makes the skills stick.
Let's talk about those courses. You mentioned the typical weekend structure. What else are they covering beyond the priorities of work?
Most intermediate courses add navigation, both map and compass and natural navigation. Natural navigation is using the sun, stars, prevailing winds, moss growth, tree shape, all the environmental cues that can give you direction without instruments. It's less precise than a compass, but it's a backup that can't break or get lost, and it connects to something deeper that survival training tries to cultivate, which is situational awareness and reading the landscape.
The moss on the north side of trees thing, is that actually reliable?
It's directionally true, but unreliable enough to be dangerous if you bet your life on it. Moss does tend to grow on the north side of trees in the northern hemisphere because that side gets less sun and stays damp. But microclimate, tree species, and local conditions can override that pattern completely. It's a data point, not a navigation system. The more reliable natural navigation techniques are things like shadow sticks. You plant a stick in the ground, mark the tip of its shadow, wait 15 minutes, mark again, and the line between the two marks runs east-west.
That's the kind of thing that feels like magic until you understand the mechanics.
That's exactly the kind of skill that in-person courses teach well because you do it yourself and watch it work. It builds confidence in a way that reading about it doesn't. The other big category that intermediate courses cover is foraging and trapping. And this is where I want to inject a note of caution. Foraging is one of the highest risk survival activities for amateurs. Misidentifying a plant can kill you. There are mushrooms where the difference between edible and lethal is nearly invisible to an untrained eye.
The mushroom foraging community has a saying, all mushrooms are edible, but some only once.
That's the one. And the military approach to foraging is correspondingly conservative. They teach a universal edibility test, a multi-step protocol where you test a small amount of the plant on your skin, then your lips, then your mouth, waiting hours between each step. It's slow and tedious, and designed for situations where you have literally no other option. In most survival scenarios, the caloric payoff of foraging is not worth the risk or the energy expenditure.
Which circles back to the point about food being the lowest priority. You can go weeks without food. You cannot go weeks without water or shelter.
The trapping piece is similarly overrated in popular culture. Setting effective snares and deadfalls is difficult and time-consuming, and success rates even for trained practitioners are low. The energy math often doesn't work. You burn more calories building and checking traps than you get from the occasional squirrel. That said, there are specific environments where trapping makes sense, and the skills are part of the advanced curriculum. Army SE Air E manual covers figure 4 deadfalls, spring snares, and fish traps, among others.
What about the medical side? I know combat medics get extensive training, but what does basic survival medicine look like?
The foundation is what's now widely taught as stop the bleed, tourniquet application, wound packing, pressure dressings. The recognition that uncontrolled hemorrhage is the number one preventable cause of death in trauma situations. Beyond that, survival medicine covers things like splinting fractures, treating burns, managing hypothermia and hyperthermia, recognizing dehydration and heat illness, and basic wound care to prevent infection. It's not surgery, it's keeping someone alive long enough to reach definitive care.
I'd imagine that's one of the areas where civilian preparedness overlaps heavily with what professionals learn. A tourniquet doesn't care whether you're special forces or an accountant.
And the proliferation of stop-the-bleed training, which is often free and takes about 90 minutes, is one of the best public health developments of the last decade. I'd recommend that to any civilian before they spend money on a wilderness survival course. The most likely emergency you'll face is not being lost in the woods. It's a car accident or a kitchen injury where someone is bleeding badly.
That's a good reality check. Let's talk about the gear side for a moment, because the prompt asks about practical skills, and gear is where a lot of people start. What's the civilian equivalent of the military loadout?
The concept you see in both military and civilian preparedness circles is the layered kit approach. Layer 1 is what's on your person: pocket knife, lighter, phone, maybe a small flashlight. Layer 2 is a day bag or go bag with more comprehensive supplies. Layer 3 is your vehicle kit. Layer 4 is your home supplies. Each layer adds redundancy without making any single layer too heavy to carry.
The contents of layer 2, the day bag, is where the debate gets religious.
But there's broad consensus on the core items: water, either a filter in containers, or water and a way to get more. Fire, multiple ignition sources, shelter, at minimum, an emergency bivy bag or space blanket, plus a way to improvise more. Navigation, compass, and map of your area. First aid, a trauma-focused kit, not just band-aids. Signaling, a whistle, a signal mirror, and ideally a personal locator beacon or satellite messenger. Food, high-calorie, no-cook items. And a multi-tool or fixed-blade knife.
The personal locator beacon is the one piece of gear that has changed the survival equation in the last 20 years. A device the size of a deck of cards that can summon rescue from anywhere on Earth.
The Garmin InReach and similar devices have made the stay or go decision dramatically easier. If you can push a button and have search and rescue know your exact GPS coordinates within minutes, staying put is almost always the right call. These devices are not cheap. You're looking at a few $100s for the device plus a subscription. But if you spend time in the backcountry, they're arguably the single most impactful piece of safety gear you can carry.
We've covered shelter, water, fire, navigation, medical, signaling. What about the skills that are harder to categorize? Knots, cordage, tool use.
Knots are absolutely foundational, and they're one of those skills that you can practice at home while watching television. The core set that every survival course teaches is maybe 6 or 7 knots. The bowline creates a fixed loop that won't slip, used for rescue lines and securing shelters. The trucker's hitch, a mechanical advantage knot for tensioning ridge lines. The tautline hitch, adjustable tension, good for tent stakes. The clove hitch, quick attachment to a pole or tree. The square knot, for joining two ropes of equal diameter. The sheet bend, for joining ropes of different diameters. And the figure 8, a stopper knot that's also the foundation for climbing knots.
6 or 7 knots? That's a weekend of practice to get competent.
A lifetime to master, but competence is enough. You don't need to be able to tie a bowline behind your back in the dark, you just need to be able to do it reliably. Another skill that often gets overlooked is cordage making. If you don't have paracord, can you make usable cordage from plant fibers? It's slow and tedious, but it's a genuine backup skill. Nettle stems, inner bark from certain trees, even some grasses can be processed into surprisingly strong cordage.
That's the kind of skill that sounds like a party trick, until you need to lash a shelter together, and your paracord is at the bottom of a river.
That's the philosophy behind a lot of the more esoteric survival skills. They're not things you plan to use, they're insurance. The military calls it degraded capability. What can you still do when your equipment is gone, when your team is separated, when the plan has fallen apart? Each layer of skill is a layer of resilience.
Let's talk about the in-person course landscape. The prompt asks what these courses typically entail and cover. We've touched on the curriculum, but what's the actual experience like?
The civilian survival course market has exploded in the last decade. You've got everything from half-day urban preparedness workshops to multi-week primitive skills intensives where you show up with nothing and learn to make everything from scratch. The most common format is a two-day weekend course. Arrive Saturday morning, camp overnight, finish Sunday afternoon. Cost typically runs somewhere between $200 and $500 depending on the instructor and location.
The overnight component is important because that's when the skills get stress tested.
That's the whole point. Building a shelter in the afternoon sun while an instructor watches is one thing. Sleeping in that shelter when the temperature drops to 40 degrees at 3 in the morning is a completely different learning experience. You find out very quickly whether you built it correctly. Most courses deliberately include this kind of controlled discomfort, not to be macho, but because discomfort is where the learning happens. Your brain encodes lessons differently when there are stakes.
The controlled discomfort piece connects back to the mental rehearsal we talked about earlier. If the first time you're cold and scared is a real emergency, you're at a disadvantage. If you've been cold and uncomfortable before, in a training context, you have a reference point. You know you can function through it.
That's one of the things the better courses do well. They scaffold the difficulty. Day one is instruction and practice. Day two is a scenario where you apply the skills with less guidance. Some advanced courses do full simulation exercises where you're lost and have to self-rescue over 24 or 48 hours. The instructors monitor from a distance for safety, but you're making your own decisions.
What about the urban side? We've been mostly talking wilderness, but a lot of the preparedness-minded civilians I know are more concerned about infrastructure disruptions, power outages, water supply issues, that kind of thing.
Urban survival is a different discipline with different priorities. The biggest immediate threats in an urban disruption are water, sanitation, and security. If the water stops running, you have about 3 days before things get desperate. And that's not 3 days for you personally, that's 3 days for everyone in your building, your block, your city. The skills shift from shelter building and fire starting to water storage and purification at scale, alternative cooking methods, waste management when toilets don't flush, and securing your home.
The waste management piece is the one nobody wants to think about until it's suddenly the most urgent problem in your life.
It's the least glamorous part of preparedness and potentially the most important. A single bout of cholera from contaminated water or poor sanitation can kill you faster than starvation. The rule of thumb for urban water storage is 1 gallon per person per day, minimum, and you want at least a 2-week supply. For a family of 4, that's 56 gallons. Most people don't have that sitting in their apartment.
Which is why the skills piece matters more than the stockpile piece for a lot of people. You can't store everything. You need to know how to improvise.
That brings us to what I think is the single most important skill that advanced survival training teaches, and it's not a technical skill at all. It's what the military calls adaptive thinking, or field improvisation. The ability to look at the resources you actually have, not the resources you wish you had, and figure out a solution. A car mirror becomes a signal device. A trash bag becomes a rain poncho. A soda can becomes a fishing lure or a fire reflector. The specific objects change, but the mental habit of asking, what can this do for me?
There's a creativity to it that I think appeals to people, even if they never plan to use the skills. The idea that you could walk into the woods with nothing and figure it out.
That's the romantic appeal of survival training, and it's not entirely wrong. But I want to be clear about something, because the prompt asks about foundational skills for civilians, and I think there's a real risk of people jumping straight to the fun stuff. Fire by friction, shelter building, wild edible plants, while skipping the things that are statistically far more likely to save their lives. The most valuable survival skill for the average person is probably first aid and CPR. After that, it's knowing how to use a fire extinguisher. After that, it's having working smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors. These are not exciting. They don't make for good YouTube content, but they save orders of magnitude more lives than bow drill skills ever will.
That's the eat your vegetables portion of the episode.
And I'll add one more vegetable, physical fitness. In almost any emergency scenario, your ability to move, to walk long distances, to carry someone, to climb, to swim, is going to matter more than whether you can identify edible plants. The Special Forces guys are effective survivors in large part because they're in extraordinary physical condition. The skills are force multipliers, but the base stat is fitness.
The hierarchy for civilians is first aid, fitness, fire extinguishers and smoke alarms, water storage, then the fun stuff.
And within the fun stuff, I prioritize fire making with modern tools. Lighters, ferro rods, over primitive methods, shelter construction with a tarp over debris huts, and map and compass navigation over natural navigation. Build the skills you're most likely to actually use.
What about the courses that are specifically marketed to the tactical or prepper community? Are those different from the general wilderness survival courses?
They often add a defensive component, situational awareness in urban environments, home security, sometimes firearms training. Some of them are excellent. Some of them are teaching things that are more about fantasy fulfillment than practical preparedness. The quality control issue in the survival training industry is real. There's no central certification body, no licensing requirement. Anyone can hang out a shingle and call themselves a survival instructor. So, due diligence matters. Look for instructors with verifiable backgrounds, ideally military SERE instructor experience or equivalent, and read reviews from past students.
The military SEEE instructor pipeline is its own thing, right? Those aren't just people who went through SERE training. They're trained to teach it.
SERE instructors go through an additional selection and training process beyond the basic SERE course. They're taught instructional methodology, safety protocols, how to run scenarios without causing psychological harm. It's a professional discipline. And the better civilian courses are often run by former SERE instructors or people who've trained under them. That lineage matters.
We've been talking mostly American context. The prompt mentions Israeli special units. Is the Israeli approach different?
The Israeli approach to survival training is shaped by a different threat environment. Israeli Special Forces, Sayeret Matkal, Sheyatet 13, the various reconnaissance units operate in desert environments primarily, so water procurement and heat management are disproportionately emphasized. But the bigger difference is that Israeli units tend to integrate survival training with combat training more tightly. It's not a separate SERE school, it's woven into the operational training pipeline. The assumption is that survival skills are combat skills, because the scenarios where an Israeli operator would need them are almost always hostile environments where capture is a real possibility.
Desert survival is its own beast. The water math is brutal.
In a desert environment, the 3-day rule for water can compress to 24 hours or less, depending on temperature and exertion level. The Israeli military teaches solar still construction. Digging a hole, placing a container in the center, covering with plastic, and using a weight to create a condensation point. But they're also realistic about the yield. A solar still might produce a liter of water per day under ideal conditions, which is not enough to sustain an active person. It's a supplement, not a solution. The primary desert survival strategy is water conservation and night movement.
Night movement to avoid the heat, and because it's harder to be spotted.
Move at night, shelter during the day. The shelter in a desert environment is often just shade, a tarp or a space blanket rigged to block direct sun. The temperature difference between direct sun and shade can be 20 degrees or more. And the Israelis are very good at something else that doesn't get talked about much in civilian survival circles, camouflage and concealment. In a hostile desert environment, being seen can be as dangerous as being thirsty.
That's the evasion piece of SERE bleeding in. We've been mostly on the survival side, but the line blurs in practice.
And that's actually a good segue to something I want to touch on, the ethical dimension of survival training. A lot of the skills we've discussed, evasion, camouflage, resistance to interrogation, are explicitly military skills designed for combatants. There's a whole conversation to be had about whether and how those should be taught to civilians. Some of the courses out there blur the line in ways that make me uncomfortable. Teaching someone how to evade pursuers and resist interrogation when they're not accountable to any chain of command is
the sheepdog fantasy industrial complex.
That's one way to put it. I think there's a legitimate civilian interest in preparedness and self-reliance. but there's also a version of this that's essentially all LARPing as a special forces operator, and that version can attract some problematic elements. The better courses are very clear about their scope. This is about wilderness survival and emergency preparedness, not about preparing for a guerrilla war.
To bring it back to the prompt's question about foundational skills for civilians, first aid, fitness, fire safety, water, shelter, navigation, with an emphasis on modern tools over primitive methods, and a healthy skepticism of anyone who wants to teach you how to evade a tracking team.
That's a good summary. And I'd add, take a course. Not because you can't learn from books and YouTube, you absolutely can, but because the hands-on practice and the controlled discomfort are what turn information into capability. You don't need to do a 2-week primitive skills intensive. A weekend course with a reputable instructor will teach you more than you expect, and it'll give you a much clearer sense of what you don't know.
The what you don't know piece is humbling, and that's probably the most valuable part.
It really is. The first time you try to start a fire with a ferro rod, after watching a dozen YouTube videos where it looks effortless and you produce nothing but sparks and frustration for 40 minutes, that's a learning experience. And the lesson isn't just about ferro rods, it's about the gap between watching and doing, which applies to almost every survival skill.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, a meteorite struck the Atacama Desert in what is now northern Chile. The iron-nickel core of that meteorite, combined with the region's extreme aridity, created a patch of soil where the mineral schreibersite, an iron-nickel phosphide, catalyzed the formation of phosphorus compounds that, under different circumstances, might have played a role in prebiotic chemistry. Essentially, a space rock accidentally built a tiny, sterile, primordial soup kitchen in the driest place on Earth.
A sterile primordial soup kitchen.
I need to think about that.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact that will now live in my head, rent-free. If you enjoyed this, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.